listening to Journeys on Revolution Radio on freedomslips.com and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth. Oh yes, oh yes, very much. Good evening, good afternoon, and good morning. Good evening if you're in Europe, good afternoon if you're in America, and good morning if you're in Australia or the other Antipodean states of being. How are we all today? This is, we're getting up to some exciting times. I'm sure everybody's feeling the kind of slight rush. It's not just the rush towards Christmas. I call it Christmas. I don't know. I don't call it holidays. It's not holiday. Yes, maybe some holy days, but there's some unholy days in there as well. So anyway, we are tonight going to be talking some very interesting stuff. I'll be speaking with Dale Benadum. We spoke the other day, just kind of on and off chance. I mean, we've met before, but we spoke the other day. And we had a very, very fascinating conversation about the a certain submarine that had had a controversy around it. Dale has a naval history, it was a very interesting conversation. And then we got onto other stuff. We were talking about what he produces, I thought, well, this is right up my street. And so today I called him up and said he'd want to come on the show. So I'd like to introduce right now. Let's just make sure you're on there. Yeah, there. I'd like to introduce for you right now, Dale Benadum. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good evening. Good afternoon. Good morning, wherever you may be in the world. That's my intro of my show too.
It's great having a kind of planetary wide. Dotted about here and there, not network of friends and listeners, and you know, I don't feel
yes,
like
yes, it.
Yeah. I was just gonna say I don't feel like I'm some sort of great broadcaster or anything like that. I'm just talking to my friends and people who might eventually become a friend. So and probably the same for you as well, Dale. Oh, now Dale is Dale. Comes and goes. We lost him a little minute ago, and he's just gone down again. So I'm just going to call him back. He's out in Texas, and I don't know exactly how his broadband situation is. He's probably on a wireless network.
There you go.
There you go. Are you on a wireless or something?
No, I'm hardwired in. I got a Cat 5 cable.
All right. Well, you dropped a couple of times. Anyway, so I'll cope with that. I'll keep an eye on the call while we're talking, and you know, if you drop out, I'll just cover and bring you back in just exactly the same as I just did. So,
sounds good.
So, where should we start? Do you want to talk about what we were talking about the other night, or do you want to go on to a completely other subject?
It's your show, brother. Where do you want to take it?
Well, I'm sure that the audience will be very interested in what we're going to talk about on both subjects. But let's have a. Do you want to quickly run by the Scorpion situation?
Yes, USS Scorpion.
Yeah.
Hull number SSN589 was a Skipjack class nuclear submarine of the Navy, and this. The sixth vessel of the U.S. Navy to carry that name. It was declared lost on June 5th of 1968 with 99 crew members dying in the accident. And that's the official story. It was one of two nuclear submarines in the U.S. Navy that were lost, the Thresher being the other one, USS Thresher. And that's about as far as I know with the history. That's what they taught us in School of Ship Training or in boot camp, the history class. Well, after having served on board the USS Theodore Roosevelt, CVN 71, that was my command. I, you know, you hear things and you meet people. And I had a unique experience on the mess decks through, I guess it was just, I was in close proximity. And this was the first time I'd really got acquainted with things are not always what they seem to be under that category. And I overheard some khakis. Now, a khaki can either be a chief petty officer, senior chief petty officer, master chief petty officer, or a commissioned officer. So I'm not going to give that a name or a rank because that's not what I'm here to do. But the incident, the conversation I heard was that the Scorpion went down to more or less, there was some hanky-panky going on. There were some things that were only privy to those that were, you know, that were aware of these operations. Now, what took place underneath? I don't know. I can only make the assumption. And when you make an assumption, I want to be careful just to make it clear that I don't have any physical evidence of this. It was just a conversation. But the conversation went something like, yeah, the Scorpion went down and they may have found a nuclear sub and they were just a little too hostile and there was some underwater entities. That was the word, entities that may have played a part in it. The other guy said, oh, yeah. And this other person said, yeah, there's a good chance. And it's been discovered that half the crew was missing. Now, they had the technology. I don't know when, but they had the technology of these spacesuits that they're able to fill up with a highly oxygenated water that they can breathe through their lungs, just like umbilical or what do they call that? Placenta fluid that the baby breathes in and out.
Well, the fluid around the baby is called amniotic, but the placenta and the umbilical is the feeding channel. So anyway, yeah, do go on. Umbilical.
They breathe this amniotic fluid, so to speak. It's they gave a great demonstration of this in a movie. And if you've ever seen The Abyss. Ed Harris, the actor, plays the actor that dons this suit. And, folks, I got to tell you, seeing the training films that I saw while I was in the Navy and watching him do it in the movie, he did it exactly the same. So he was doing that. They are literally showing us the technology that they had at the time. But this technology goes back decades prior. So they had made... According to the conversation, that they had made a dive and they had scoured the ocean floor for several miles either way because I guess the ship broke in half, the boat, Navy, we call them boats. Submarines are called boats. Naval vessels above the surface are called ships. And the boat had... broken in half, so they were looking for the bodies, and they couldn't find almost half the crew were missing.
And it had been cracked. It's been like broken, like a pretzel.
Good question. I haven't seen photos. Wait a minute here. I got something here on Wikipedia with it. So, looks to me, from the photos they're showing here, the bow section, or the aft end of the ship, looks to be around maybe just about where the rudders and stabilizers are at. Looks like it's here, stern section of Scorpion, seen in 1986 by Woods Hole personnel. So, obviously, they were looking for bodies. Well, they didn't even find bones. And then the topic came up. Well, it's more than likely they were taken by the underwater terrestrials. So then the conversation got kind of quiet, and I was kind of garbled, but I heard the words inner earth dwellings. Then I heard hollow earth dwellings. I'm like, oh, so that was my first time baptized into this whole knowledge of hollow earth and inner earth.
Yeah.
And since I've come to know that it is indeed true, and I've met a colonel that I'm sure we'll get into here soon.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. So basically you're overhearing a conversation between a tech and some other dude. But your ears are pricked up, and you're listening to this very carefully. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Being on the mess decks is kind of loud anyway. You get commotion. You got walkways. It connects to the passageways on both sides. So there's a lot of foot traffic. There's just a lot of noise on the mess decks. Just like being in a restaurant, a loud restaurant. So it was kind of hard to pick up, but I was able to make out that it sounded like, to me, what I was able to piece together is that there's a good possibility that they were taken off of the sub. How the sub went down, I don't know. I'm not even going to hypothesize how the event occurred that brought the sub down, but it's probable that the entire crew may have been taken off, been told, hey, this is who we are. We've been here, X amount of years, so many years. You're messing with our home, and we're not going to permit you to do it. We're giving you the choice now. We can adopt you into our family. However, your surface life on Earth is over, or you choose to go back to the sub and meet your fate. So then it leads into, well, gosh, where did they go? Well, as time has it, excuse me, and years later, things begin to unfold, and I have become aware that indeed there are subterranean cavernous cities that do exist. And they are populated by people. What their names are, what they call themselves, I don't know. But there's a network of these, and they call themselves. It's called the Agarthian Network, and it lies within the crust of the Earth. Now, there's also another place called Hollow Earth, and I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt, I've had an experience that yes, indeed, it is there. It is true. It's a very loving. Think of heaven. The Bible describes heaven. This would be it. And I can only assume that they were given a choice. Okay, fine. I'll take this new life. It's, one can only imagine, what they felt or what they were going through. But no matter that, knowing what I know now, I can only assume that it was a much more loving peaceful, a change in one's life, know, going from a military life to a whole new realm of possibilities and existence.
Right. So these guys are given an opportunity to either go to heaven or die a watery death.
Again, I'm just making an assumption a hypothesis here. Indeed. Yes.
Yeah. So, so this is. In terms of the veracity of this is a conversation you overheard. So it's like multiple hearsay. However, when you speak about it, I get shivers down my spine. Oh God, my ears just gone as well. Get whistling in the ears and all of this stuff. So there's all kinds of confirmations that are going on that what you're talking about is actually a real thing. Now, we've had personal conversations with Colonel Woodard. So is there any more in that from that period of time of that overheard conversation.
We're forgetting about what I saw too on board the ship.
Yeah, of course. So, so you had this, you heard this conversation, and that was when? That was in the 80s. Yeah?
Oh, geez. That was on the first deployment, so that was in 88 to 89. We were on the first cruise. Let's see, I wrote this down because I did a little investigating. We came back on that first cruise in 30 June of 89.
Right.
So it was the end of June of 1989. Mm-hmm. And I would say, oh gosh, about 2 days prior to that. There was an event that occurred, you know, not so nice event. And before I go any further, I just want to simply say I enjoyed my time in the Navy. I had 4 years of an adventure that I cherish to this day. And what I'm about to say, I am not out here to give the Navy a black eye. I'm not here to create any discontent. But it's time to start releasing this knowledge that of other sailors that have come forward. And there have been others that have come forward on other platforms as well. So I'm not the only one. But it's not uncommon to see UFOs around those Navy ships that are carrying nuclear weapons. Hmm. We have heard this from different avenues on other shows on other platforms. So this is nothing new. I'm here to tell you my story and not put anything more into it, because as we all know, a lot of this information is not coming out and truth will be set free. So that's what I'm doing today. So
that's true. And I want to, first of all, thank you for your courage in doing so, Dale, because it's not an easy thing to disobey those orders.
Yeah. It's one of those things you put in the back burner for 20 years, figuring, you know, when the time's right, it'll come out. And that's, so this is the time. Back in 1989, we were going through the Navy. We had a few black eyes, and I had come into the Navy during the mishap that happened aboard the USS Iowa, the battleship Iowa, and I was already in the Navy when the scandalous Tailhook Convention came out. So I was in no way wanting to give the Navy a black eye at that time with coming out with this information, but here it is. 2 days prior, I think 2 or 3 days prior to us returning to the Norfolk Naval Shipyard, there was an exercise on the fantail of the ship, on the rear of the ship. There was a rather large platform out there, and it's used for testing purposes from the airframes department. They test, they have a machine shop in the back there for working on aircraft engines. Anyway.
But we're talking about an aircraft carrier that is like how long? How wide?
I believe it was 1,056 feet from bow to stern. So it's rather large, rather long. Carries, I don't know the exact amount, but it's upwards to 5,000. Plus,
so this
members
is,
when it's full of full
this
of
is
companies.
No small boat. This is a ship.
Oh man, it's a floating city, brother. It's,
yeah,
it's got a store, barber shop, 2 mess decks for the enlisted. They got reefers, refrigerated units that hold all of the freezers and the frozen and refrigerated goods that you could play soccer ball in. And they're huge,
massive.
Anyway, getting to the event. All right. There was what is called as a dumping party, and it involved the ship's safety department, the safety department head, the officer, and also every other department head on that ship, including squadron, were there. Now, I never find out why, but I can only assume that they were there to be an accomplice to the crime, so to speak. I don't know if it's a crime, but what was transpiring was they were collecting all of the spent paint that had not been consumed or used in the containers that they were stored in, like 5 gallon containers and all the spent paint in the 1 gallon containers that they would transfer to. And the reason they do this is because they have to pay to have that removed and processed when they get back to the yard. So if they have no paint to process, they don't have to spend any money.
So they tax it on the way back. So this is toxic stuff. This is paint for metal, isn't it? Which is pretty nasty, like hamerite.
Industrial quantities
of hamerite.
Well, remember, a lot of this stuff is latex too, so it's water based. But I can't tell you for certain whether or not the really bad stuff, the exterior paints, were in this. But I could tell you that they had a lot of colors of birthing spaces, like your pale pink, your blues, your green. This stuff was dumped over the side, and there was a paint slick that I couldn't see the end of. So they had been dumping for quite a while. And I could tell you this, that safety department head officer was not at all enthused to be doing this. And I have seen him walk the decks in previous times, and the guy always had a state of fear on his face. I could feel it back then. You could see it in the man. He just was not kosher with what he was doing. And, you know, I felt that, and I felt his pain. I'm like, God, man, just the things that we do in the name of free enterprise or freedom is, you know, there's some things that have to be accounted for. And I just never felt that this was accounted for. And that's why I'm coming out with it. And it's something that I could also feel that while they were dumping this, I'm like, God, I mean, if we're dumping all of this stuff, how many other vessels out there in the Navy, not only the Navy, but how many other vessels that sail the seas do this practice? And I thought, geez, man, really? Ocean is nothing more than a dumping ground? Well, yeah. It's quite common. They have the ability to take the shipboard sewage, which, as you can only guess, would really consume a lot of space in a holding tank. So they have a process where they're able to run it through a grinder. I don't know what the technical terminology of it is, but once the holding tanks get to a certain point, as it's coming out, they're able to chew it up. And they do use toilet paper, like, you know, that will dissolve in salt water. So there is some planning and care that does take place, but still, it's dumping raw sewage in the sea. This is probably the common way of processing this kind of stuff with all ships. So, you know, there's not much you could do about that because it is what it is. It just, you know, you got a sewage plant. And processes the sewage, dumps it over the side. But paint is a different story. You know, I don't care if it is latex. There's still elements in there that are not to come naturally from nature. These pigments are created, you know, with different elements. So
yeah, and a lot of colors, pigment doesn't come from nowhere. They come from products. You know, it's not just you can't just make any kind of paint. There are certain colors that occur in nature, like lapis lazuli to make blue, for instance, or cochineal, which is made of insects, to make red, and things like that. So there are, I mean, it could be like an arsenic product or something like that to make these paints. And I know white paint is titanium.
Well, so I can tell you that the battleship gray exterior, the weathered, they call weather paint, the exterior paint on a ship, has got toxins in it that prevents it from rusting. But it still doesn't,
what it does is it slows it down. It doesn't completely eradicate it, because when the ship comes back from a 6-month deployment, you've got Sol, you know, sea spray that's literally covered the ship. And when they come back into port, they're well weathered, they're rusty, and there's a lot of work that goes into keeping ships maintained. It's crazy. But so when they're applying this stuff, they have to wear a jumpsuit, a respirator, eyewear, eye goggles, gloves. You have to tape your gloves to your stuff. So that paint is some pretty nasty stuff. And I can only hope that that wasn't included in that dumping. But taking it from there, that night, this happened in the morning, and that night, something very peculiar happened. I was friends with a bosun mate, and he had a watch. I just happened to walk out, and he was on watch. You can walk around the ship and get out on the sponsons if there's no flight operations in play. So the stern was insecure, and I walked out just to get some fresh air and see the night air and see the beautiful stars in the sky. My gosh, just it's unbelievable when you're out at sea. So anyway, we're sitting there talking, and all of a sudden we look around the starboard side, and that's where his watch was at, and we saw this light in the water, submerged, and it was bright white light. And I would assume that the footpath of this was large enough to put comfortably the footprint of the ship in.
Which we've already established is over 1,000 feet long.
Yeah.
So we're talking something with a diameter, a light with a diameter of more than 1,000 feet. Just the light. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I would have ruined a pair of trousers at that point.
Well, yeah. Well, we did kind of get a little excited, and then he started saying, hey, just calm down, let's see what this is. And as we got closer, the ship did not turn. So he radioed up to, because, you know, he carries a set of, you know, earphones and sound-powered phones with a mic, and he made contact with the bridge. The bridge said, no, we don't see anything. And he says, you're kidding. I'm looking right at it. As a matter of fact, it's right under the ship right now. And they said, we don't see anything. So I can only assume that I was meant to see it, and so we see. Well, he started getting real nervous because, you know, his mind went into, you know, battle mode, and mine was more or less in a kind of like a curious mode. I'd really get spaz out or get frantic. I just told him, I said, hey, hold on a minute, I'll just see what happens here. So as it started to dim, the lights literally started to really dim down, and there was like a soft glow that came about it. But it was still bright enough that when the ship went over top, I could see number three and number four screw turning. And it wasn't too far below that. And so we're talking probably it was in about 30 foot of water. Maybe 20, 30 foot. And what I saw was a myriad of moving colors, moving like fluid movement, like the lava in a lava lamp. And it was colors like purple, pink, bluish, pale colors too, you know, pale and light. And it was, it had life to it, you know? So, and as it come right beneath us and looked down, I'd had this thought that just overwhelmed me, like, we're here. It'll be okay.
and you know, just that was it. I just had a feeling of calmness come over me.
So there was the sense of like you were overshadowed with this feeling.
Yeah,
and that it was not unfriendly. It was benign.
I got the feeling that it was just there to say, hey, we're here. We know what you did earlier in the day. We know you can't control, but we're just here to let you know that you're crapping on our lawn, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. This is the great ignorance that we surround, you know, we're steeped in. There's this, mm-hmm. this huge arrogance that, you know, these tiny little land creatures are the only people on this planet. God's sake. You know.
Yeah, we've got civilizations that live all over this planet, above and below.
And inside it, and in every, there is life teeming. Every square Airport. Millimeter of this galaxy.
Yeah, and even in the ones that we don't see.
That's right, because we're inner being.
Yeah, a lot of these beings exist in higher vibrations, or what you refer to as higher dimensions.
Mm.
So it's not that we don't see them, but we can still sense them, but a lot of people that are waking up now are seeing them. I haven't gotten that lucky yet, but that's fair. That's okay. You know, everyone has their time. All right, let's put it this way. I've seen and felt enough so far. I'm convinced. And that was a real big wake-up call in my young... That's just one of many wake-up calls in my young life. And, yeah, well, I kept that with me.
You know, there's no accident, and you're here because you're here, and because of your, your mission here on this planet. So... now I've got a couple of questions that are coming in from the chat, but I also want to, and I also want to move on to from your experience to your meeting and stuff. So I have a question from, of course, Rainbow Warrior. What colors did you see? Once more with the light that was under the water. Did you say you estimated it was about 30 feet below the surface?
I can't give out the details how big the screws are, because that's giving away too much information that really no one needs to know. But it was, I would say it was in water. It was about 30 foot deep.
Okay.
And the colors were like a pale. There were pale colors in. The glowing colors of like a pink and purple and violet and blue. I think there was even a little bit of orange in there mixed in with it. And it was just moving. It had life to it. It was changing. It was fluid movement like that, like the lava in a lava lamp.
Beautiful. So it sounded like if you could make a machine that would do that, it would be a very relaxing thing, wouldn't it? You could heal people with that.
Well, see, and since this whole experience of life has shown me so far, and what I was witnessing was, this was intelligent life. This was something that, and we've heard in the I've heard about this in the past with these especially with our starships. The craft that exists in other dimensions, that the ships themselves carry on a symbiotic relationship with the crew, with the inhabitants within the ship, meaning the ship itself has a sense of consciousness and life to it. And that's kind of what I felt at that time when I saw this craft in the water, this underwater submerged object. And then once it passed, it was out there for probably, I would say, two ship lengths, and then it just faded below the water and drifted away into the darkness. So, yeah, I just felt then it was someone reaching out saying, hey, you know, we know you crept in our yard. We don't like it. We're just here to show us that stop it. That's what it felt like.
So, So that was this experience, and you got that, you know, you got a signature from you got a feeling from them that you'd recognize again, eh?
Oh yeah. Yeah, and I have since.
Yeah, yeah. So here's another thing from SJ. I think that's Sunshine Jim. He greets you from a fellow mariner.
Greetings, my brother.
You know, I have so much respect for people who live, work, exist on boats and ships. You know, I get seasick just crossing a bridge, it's. Last time I was on a boat, I spent all of my time below the deck, emptying myself, as it were. It wasn't a good the ship that sank.
Yes, I didn't have to worry too much about that. That ship was so large, it pretty much plowed through the water and made its own wake. However, there were occasions when we were in rough seas, and I can recall one incident where we were doing what's referred to as con reps and vert reps. And we were taking on supplies and stores, and the seas were so rough that this.
Oh, there we go. We seem to have lost Ben Dale for a second there. The ship that bounces up and down. I hate that. So let's just call him back there and bring him back in. And, you'll grow. it's not the rocking motion so much as that kind of sudden up and down motion. You know, like when you go over a bridge really fast, you know, and your stomach goes, as you're dropping in free fall about, you know, maybe.
There we go.
Hey, how you doing? I was just saying, you know, that what I don't like about the boat, it's not the rocking side to side so much. It's the immediate and rapid drop or rise that is like when you go over a bridge too fast in a car, whereupon you're moving like 3 inches maybe, but you know, this ship is dropping like 20 feet in less than a second.
that exercise we were going through with during that con rep and vert rep, or no, it was, that was a vert rep because we couldn't do con reps with the line, so we were going through a vertical replenishment. And that's with helicopters. But, yeah, the seas were so rough. I remember looking out over one of the sponsons, which I wasn't supposed to be on, but I was able to get out. And I looked down underneath the ship, and when our rear of the ship came out of the water, you could see the props spinning. Ooh. And that's some rough seas when you see a carrier's rear end come out of the drink.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet.
It didn't come all the way out, but it came out enough. You can see screws turning, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to feel this when it bottoms out.
Yeah. So, anyway, let's go back to Terra Firma for a minute. From Terra Firma down below is, you know, it's really interesting. You were saying earlier about this sense that, you know, what we call heaven might actually be below our feet. Now, obviously, you know, we've been told everything is a lie. And maybe the idea that heaven's in the sky and hell is below us might be the other way around, is that hell is in the sky and heaven is inside this nice little cocoon bubble that we call the hollow earth on the fifth dimension. So let's now fast forward several years
and
because, you know, obviously, you know, you've got lots of other stories, but I want to talk about the things, yeah? And so you eventually do you meet physically or you're just meeting on Skype with Colonel Woodard?
Well, it started off in May of 2011. I was looking through some YouTube videos and saw this interview of this Colonel Billy Fay Woodard, who more or less looked like a hippie. He has long hair, and he was speaking that, you know, he was in this interview, he was saying that he was born in Hollow Earth, and in the right around our time in the 1950s, he was given a mission And he accepted a mission to come to the surface and tell the people of the existence of the Hollow Earth inhabitants and those of the Inner Earth inhabitants, and the process of just bringing this information to the surface and let people understand and start to get used to the idea that these folks are loving. These are our ancestors. They're loving, joyous, and in perfect harmony with Mother Earth. And when the time comes that they're going to be bringing forth all of their knowledge and technology and getting us reacquainted of who we are as a species, where we came from, and where we would like to go. So I made contact through his website, hollowearthnetwork.com, and sent an email off to the webmaster. And she says, well, here's his phone number. Give him a call. So I did. And at the time, he was living in Pahrump, Nevada. And
well, that's a familiar sounding place. Who else lives in Pahrump, Nevada? Let me just think.
Tremjar.
No. Hang on a second.
Anybody? Yeah. Anyone who had anything to do with special assignments in the Air Force or any branch of the service always has a tendency or propensity to move to Pahrump. So it's a hotbed of a lot of former active military that retire there, and some live in secrecy and some don't. So but, the story with him.
There's a story everybody, eh? So, yeah. So the story with Woodard is what happens.
Well, he was taken when he accepted his mission in Hollow Earth. He was taken to their chambers, and they did a reverse transition on him, and his body was changed from adult or from a teenage male into a third density or third dimensional infant body, which is what we are, the third dimensional beings. And he was deposited, him and his sister both were deposited on, I think it was close to somewhere there in the city square of a town up there in the northern part of Texas. I think it's Texarkana. I think that's the name of the town. And they were discovered and taken to the orphanage where him and his sister were adopted out to an Air Force family. And his name was Woodard. And then they grew up in a not so loving family, more or less. He was told, and he shared with this on previous shows that I did with him in the very early, in the early shows, one of my shows, shared that he was told basically that they were nothing more than a tax write-off, and they were able to get assistance, get money for having them. And they grew up in the attic of the house for most of their adolescent years. And then when their abilities – and see, they didn't talk for a real long time because they were able to communicate to one another. Billy's sister and himself were able to mind talk with one another because that's quite common down in Hollow Earth. So they really didn't speak till, I don't know, maybe in their early teens. And during this, I think the Air Force, the father, discovered that they had certain abilities, and he ended up selling his son. Or I don't know what happened with the daughter. Well, I do and I don't. But Billy was more or less sold to the Air Force for $1 million. So, you know, I mean, that's pretty.
It's just a thing. He was just a plaything. And I mean, look, I know that this is actually a very distressing story. We have an interview in the Wolf Spirit Radio archives, and you've got interviews on your archives giving all the detail. But, Dale, we've got 15 minutes, man. Get to the headband.
Okay, so for the last year and a half, we've been talking about he has been sharing through his father, Zor, who trains channels through Billy and been giving us a lot of information. So the headbands. Okay, we'll get to the headbands.
You can look at these headbands on hollowearthnetwork.com right now under the tab Headband Orders. What he was given, Billy was given the information from his father to build these headbands, or given permission to go ahead and make these headbands. And what these do is they act as a transmitter and a receiver. You wear them around your head. They're made out of copper, soft rolled copper. They have a silver or a gold coin attached to it, which acts as a capacitor. And then they have a clear quartz Lumerian crystal attached to the top of the coin. And I wrap the copper around these, around the coin and the crystal, so all three are touching. And it acts as a communication device. And but it also does more than communicate to other beings. It also will help realign the chakras within your body, and especially the chakras that are now being discovered in the head. There's more than one chakra. There's several. So what it does is it takes your pituitary and pineal glands, and it starts to realign them in an energetic way to where we're rediscovering who and what we are. You can get healing. You could use it for meditations. You can use it for healing work. This is something that can be worn every day, but I advise people when you first face that you feel like it's bare shoes. You want to start wearing it slowly, meaning one of the first side effects is you start getting dizzy, you know, or to give you a headache. And if it does, simply take the thing off. Simply take it off for a while. Let your body's getting accustomed to something that's new. So you're going to have effects to it. But you can achieve levels of clairvoyance, clairaudio, clairvisual with this thing. And I actually, in July of this year, had a trip that took me through a wormhole, and I got to see Hollow Earth. And it was very unexpected. And I wrote about it there on the headband page at the bottom. And basically what I saw and felt was that the first thing that I noticed was I wasn't in my body, but I felt as if I was an orb, because I could see 60 degrees all at once, all around me and above me and below me. I noticed that I could smell the air, and the air was actually pristine, perfect, clean air. I could have movement, but I really couldn't land on anything, but I could visually look at something, pick up what that being was thinking or saying, and I could look at the fruits or look at the, you know, the tree or whatnot, and I could smell it just by the visual. You know, you're able to pick up scent through the visual cortex of whatever I was in at this time of the decision that I experienced. So the headbands, Billy was making them, and he turned the business over to me because he wanted to move on to other things, freeing him up from having to do all the intense labor that goes into creating the headbands. So that's what I do now. I create these headbands. I am not unfamiliar with Reiki healing. I did get my Reiki master's certificate. And coincidentally, I am able to manifest the energy in the hands that's needed for doing healing work. So instead of taking that route of going to healing work, I decided, well, I take what I already know and I fuse this energy into the headbands, just like Billy would do. And this is what it does: is it infuses all of the energies to work in cooperation with each other, and fuse that into it, so that the person wearing the headbands can start to experience it. Now, I tell everybody, look, there's no money-back guarantee in these things, so it really depends upon you and the stage of evolution, your spiritual walk that you're at. But eventually, everyone will. You have to put the work into it, the time and the effort in your meditations, and utilize this. All this is it assists the mind. It assists the breaking of that veil, and it adds to your experience levels. And the more you wear it, the more you feel from it. But I also give a disclaimer: this is a tool, and it can hurt you. If you wear this when you're in a negative mind state, it's going to amplify that. So understand this is a great tool to be used while meditating. And then once you get accustomed to how it works and how you're starting to feel the effects, then yes, you can wear it longer. And there are people that wear them all day. And I have plenty of testimonies on that page as well.
And you could probably wear it underneath a hat, probably.
Yes, I have two types. I have one that's the original headband. The other one is my creation. It's my design. It's just the original headband and then my little flair to it. And I call that one the Sun Raising Stars. That one, you're going to have a little trouble wearing underneath the hat. But if you have a skull cap, I suggest, yeah, if you want to wear one, get the original headband. It's the cheaper than two, and they work. And you can wear it under a skull cap with these, and it's great. It's great comfort fit, too. I put a piece of neoprene on the back to give it some cushion.
Yeah.
And prevents the...
Yeah. Because wearing a hard metal thing against your forehead is actually quite uncomfortable. I've tried it.
Yeah.
I've hammered some pipe into a round shape, some copper pipe. Just experimenting, and to get the kind of finish that you've got, it needs to be rolled. You know, I couldn't get anything like the kind of quality that you've got. And I have to say, you know, I've seen stuff like this around the web, and the price that you charge it's a steal. I think you're really underselling it. But they are so. Tell us what this thing. All right. Why would anybody want to wear this thing? And,
I'll give you just a quick history lesson. It was originated from the planet Mu, or Lemur. And this is where Billy's father, Zora, was originated from. This is where he was born. Geographically moved within the Hollow Earth, and so the technology comes from ancient Lemurian times, even when they founded the continents or occupied the continents of Atlantis in the Atlantic and Lemuria in the Pacific. So this technology has been around for eons, predates Egyptian times, even Egypt One. There's two histories there of Egypt. So this is going back many, 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 many hundreds of thousands of years. I can't say exactly when, but this technology is coming back to the surface, and this is just one tidbit that's been given to those who follow the Hollow Earth Network and know about what's going on. And Lemurians, actually, there's a few photos I found on the web that actually portray some of these portraits of people have drawn with these headbands, and they have no idea what these were, but they saw this vision and they incorporated into their portrait of these different spiritual leaders of these cities that I don't like to say that they run them, but they could be spiritual leadership that takes place in these cities. So it's a great piece of it's a unique piece of jewelry that you can wear, but it also has a lot of power, that energetic power that does come through it and broadcast. You can speak. I haven't been able to yet, but there are others that are highly more advanced. Spiritually or energetically on a vibratory scale that are able to make contact with folks, and they do talk to off-worlders with them.
So that's a very interesting thing, because I mean, really, actually, the show that I was editing earlier on, we were talking about, you know, galaxies. Mm-hmm. Distant galaxies, they have no distance if you're talking on the old headband. You know, I think
Right. Really
people in general like to have a thing. It helps them to focus, helps to focus the idea that you've got, you've got something that is helping your innate ability, even though that innate ability might actually in the end exceed the ability that a device gives you. But what you're saying is that it doesn't matter how much you're developed telepathically, it will always enhance it because it's an amplifier. You know, as SJ in the chat room says, it's a excellent, that's a solid state amplifier. Because you've got a capacitor and you've got crystal vibration going on there.
Right.
And
there
the crystal
you go.
Is acting as an aerial, and your brain, your chakras are being connected in through the copper band.
Well, let's look at what we already do know,
yeah.
JP.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, so cram it in.
Crystals are already being used in radio equipment today. If you ever remember the old transistor radios, there were copper in there. There were crystals that were embedded in those. Today, citizens or CB radio, they have crystals in these things that have to do with transmission and receiving. So it's a storage device, a communication, and a receiver. Depends on how you know what application you use it to. So yeah.
So yeah. So this is great. We're coming up to the end. Dale Benedum, quickly, your website. Where can people buy your thing?
HollowEarthNetwork.com. Click on to the headband orders page, and you could order directly from there via credit card, debit card, and then the PayPal is what processes it.
Excellent. HollowEarthNetwork.com.
Listening to Revolution.